Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half, the New Statesman's Culture Podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
Kate, are you going to sit down or are you going to loom above me?
The back half is the appropriate title for me today. My back hurts. And now I'm sitting down. But I do have one of those 1990s style back chairs, which is fitting with our themes as well, where you kneel and it's got like a weird bit for your bum and then you like kneel on this.
So there's no back. It's a backless chair.
There's no back. And they were all the rage in about 1992. And I think they were discredited. But, you know, I've got one. I got the company to buy one.
You're still working on 90s.
Yeah.
90s science.
And it hurts in a whole different way.
What about sitting on a ball? Is that something people
I
still do?
I couldn't sit on a ball because that requires a lot of internal core strength, doesn't it?
Like what is that
else
what it's
is,
for?
Yeah.
Do you sit on a ball to develop your core strength?
Yeah, so you have to develop this ridiculously rock-hard abdominal cave and I can't get one no matter how much I try. So I just slump and then stand. But now I'm sitting.
Standing is a very... There's a sort of long lineage of, you know, people with their standing desks. Like, I'm sure I'm going to get this wrong, but Philip Roth, either Roth or Updike, did Dickens do it?
Dickens probably just wrote while walking.
19th century, you know. Yeah. He just spoke it all
midnight into
his iPhone. Yeah.
Maybe I just need to have like a Alan Partridge style, you know, monkey tennis dictaphone that I speak everything into.
Well, you have been doing that a bit.
I have been doing
recently,
that.
When
I go to an interview and I get my impressions of
you
somebody.
Sent me one of your impressions.
What was the impression? Oh, you sent me
a little voice memo because you can be bothered to text me. And you know the only other person who does that?
Who does that?
Is a Polish builder I know called Wojciech who never texts me but always records a little voice memo.
It's
and sends
so
it to
good.
Me.
This is on WhatsApp, obviously. My friends and I communicate that way now, and it's nice because you don't have to have the agony and awkwardness of a real phone call where you're kind of worried about speaking over them and then when they've stopped and what you say next and stuff, because you just do it in your own time.
This is the sort of thing that leads older people to fear for the future of humanity, that we're not going to be able to have proper conversations anymore.
But isn't it more human than a text message?
Yeah. Mm. Arguably. Mm.
I was going to say
I was going to start by saying that it's quite an exciting time in the world of culture. We've had the Man Booker Prize shortlist this morning. We've got the Goldsmiths Prize shortlist next week. We've got the Mercury Prize shortlist tonight.
The ceremony tonight.
Yeah. Sorry, not the
shortlist.
Real
thing.
They're the actual winner of the 2018 Hyundai Mercury Prize for Music. Kate, you've judged the prize in the past. Is there anything sort of notable?
The strange
this year?
Thing about the Mercury Prize is that the thing that wins is always completely obvious to the judges, I would say. And completely unobvious to the outside world, which is why it attracts such negative press every year about the fact that it's obscure.
Right.
And, you know, well, what I find really weird about it is that the bookie's favourite is always so far off even the top three that are going to be decided between. And I don't understand why people haven't put that together and stopped, like, thinking about the bookie's favourite at all. I mean, it really doesn't.
So who's the bookie's favourite this year?
I mean,
year?
Now I'll probably be wrong, but the bookie's, one of the bookie's favourites this year is Sons of Kemet.
Yeah.
Who are a jazz, an amazing kind of jazz group with sort of skronky, saxophony kind of wild feel to them. I saw them once in a festival in a downpour at night, like midnight. And they're very exciting, sort of tribal sounding band. But they've been nominated a million times because there's often a jazz band on there. But it's been, I don't know, it's been very, very long time since a jazz band has won, if ever. So I think that it just seems odd that that's one of the bookies' favourites. Unless, and this I'm going to contradict myself here, but sometimes the judges decide to award something to something that has been nominated many times and has deserved it. And they've finally done the album that deserves it. So this may be the case with this one.
The what usually happens with that in sort of prize lore, especially in terms of the Oscars, is that it gets to the point where it's sort of embarrassing and you have to give them the prize, but unfortunately it's like their weakest piece of work,
because they nearly they happen with Radiohead.
I think that happened with Scorsese, and it probably happened with Radiohead.
Same in the books world?
Certainly for the, how many people actually bet on these things? I think it's probably relative to sport, it must be tiny. So I think bookmakers like Ladbrokes and William Hill do it as a bit of PR, because they always get name checked in the piece written in the Times or the Guardian or whatever.
And so, it helps the prize as well to have the, it's kind of a I scratch your back, you scratch mine type of thing.
So I think it's, I think they do it probably mainly for the PR. I'm not sure how they work out what they think in terms of the Mercury. For the Booker, they
sneeze.
Bless you.
That's not happening. That's a first. Carry on.
Good direct sort of aim at the microphone. Luckily, we have shields over our microphones to prevent us. Sort of,
but you know what I did unconsciously really there is I made sure it sounded like a sneeze, just in case it was weird. Because sometimes they come out like a cough. I thought there were listeners. It has to sound like a sneeze.
We could, of course, go out and edit it back. But the Booker, they often tend to just go for the one they've heard of, or the one that's kind of had the most column inches. But it's never right.
It's never the right.
So I'm pretty sure we've just had the Booker shortlist this morning. I'm pretty sure from the long list, I'd have to go back and check, but I think Sally Rooney was very high up that, and she hasn't even made it onto the shortlist.
Yeah.
So obviously she's not going to win.
Well, we can revisit this in a couple of weeks' time and prove how wrong we were about our theory that we've just created.
But I think you're right. I haven't judged anything as prestigious as the Booker Prize, but I think I can see how, from a judge's point of view, you feel like the winner is the kind of logical choice. But from the outside, it can feel kind of completely random.
Mm. And that's one of the sad things about Mercury as well, with the Young Fathers year, which I was very kind of invested in. You know, you just knew that as soon as they were announced, everyone would be turning off their TVs, or people of a certain age and sort of bent would be just turning off their TVs, thinking this is so typical Mercury's. And it's like, the reason that won is that we all knew it was brilliant. And
I don't think people would think that about Young Fathers, though, because they're so obviously so dynamic, and there's so much talent there, and they're really exciting. Mm. They're not a kind of chin strokey kind of avant-garde jazz combo. They've got a pop sensibility in there. Okay, some of their stuff is a bit difficult. Oh, so I should correct myself. I have judged something as prestigious as the Booker. I've judged the Goldsmiths Prize.
Yes, of course.
You know, arguably now more prestigious than the Booker.
So this week.
Yeah, this week we're not going to talk about any of that stuff.
We're going to talk about a film that came out 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And a show that many of you may never see.
So, King of Thieves, the Hatton Garden movie with Michael Caine and friends, and The Clock, which is Kristen Markley's new installation. Do we call it an installation? I think we do call it an installation at Tate Modern. And as usual, we will have our non-anniversary for you to enjoy. Okay, we went to see King of Thieves. Sorry, I'm rustling my papers here. We went to see King of Thieves.
I'm rustling mine as well.
Let's rustle together. Which, as probably you all know, is a film of the Hatton Garden, the 2015, is it? When it happened?
April 2015, Easter weekend.
Hatton Garden robbery. I've heard that this is the fourth screen realisation of this.
Which is hard to believe.
Two films and one miniseries. Yeah. Where have these been? I don't know.
Maybe they were just sort of amateur projects and screened in private houses.
Amdram Productions. So it's notable for its cast: Michael Caine, Jim Broadbent, Tom Courtney, Charlie Cox, Paul Whitehouse, Michael Gambon, and Ray Winston. And what's the premise, Kate?
The premise. This was known at the time as the last heist of traditional British villainy. You know, it took 3 years for them to research, because they did research this crime. I think they came away with £20 million worth of jewellery. And two-thirds of that is still missing. It took place over 3 days, Easter weekend 2015. It involved breaking into the basement of a safe deposit place in Hatton Gardens and literally burrowing through a 20-inch thick concrete wall and getting all the stuff out. And they did it over 3 days. And the significant thing was they were all in their 60s. And at the time, there were theories put about, there was suggestion that they were Navy SEALs, because nobody else but a Navy SEAL could have penetrated that safe, or Serbian master diamond thieves.
Eastern European, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, because of course we have to import all our talent these days as a country, so we can't even do our own heist properly. Of course these are foreign people and we're not going to find them. So they although they sort of sprang into action relatively fast to try and find them, the actual crooks went home to like Enfield and sat around for 6 weeks counting their jewels and meeting up down the pub. One thing I thought that was a shame that I don't believe they recreated in the film itself was that the way they were finally caught by this elite team of policemen who were watching them for 7 weeks and tailing them was that they were in the pub. And one of them on CCTV was seen standing up and miming his use of the drill that he used to get through the concrete and then going boom, which they then analyzed on they lip read him on the CCTV footage, and they saw that he was saying boom, and that enabled them to swoop in. So do you remember that in the film? Because I don't think they actually
did that in the film.
That would have been a perfect comedy moment.
Why not? Yeah.
What on earth, you know?
Yeah.
But the thing about this movie is that the poster sort of worked against it at first, because it was so, the ensemble cast was so dazzling. Mm. It's just these like seven guys just standing there, and you think this is going to be a really, really crappy movie with an amazing ensemble cast. And what did we think of it?
Well, I looked at the reviews of this and it's been roundly slated.
Yes, I was surprised.
Three-star reviews. And I have recently begun to worry that in kind of parenthood, I go to the cinema so infrequently that I'm just so delighted to be sitting in a cinema or a screening room somewhere that I maybe get overexcited about things. But I think we liked it, didn't we?
It was brilliant.
I liked it. Yeah, it was fun. It was really, I don't think anyone's going to argue it's a life-changing film. But I was very well primed for it. I'd just been watching Mark Kermode's excellent Secrets of Cinema series and his episode Deconstructing the Ingredients of a Heist Movie. Then I rewatched Sexy Beast, which is another kind of brilliant one last job heist movie from the early noughties, directed by Jonathan Glazer, also featuring Ray Winston, who's in this. And this seemed to me, I think it's been criticised a lot for neither being a rollicking caper and at the same time not being a kind of gritty, cutting-edge crime film. And actually, I kind of like the fact that it chucked both of those elements together. So it's got a great opening, brilliant slice of six, it's Small Faces, What You're Going to Do About It, playing really loud over the opening. Which, by the way, it's got a brilliant sort of bass break in that song. It's kind of a scuzzy guitar.
The music's really strong in the film, isn't it? There's a specially composed jazz soundtrack all the way through. Yeah. It's like very, very slick.
And they do this nice thing at the beginning and a couple of moments throughout, which again, a lot of critics didn't like, of cutting back to little clips of like pulpy 60s crime movies, which gives you a feel of kind of some sort of London glamorous London crime underworld, which you can then contrast to the fairly kind of these over the hill guys kind of contemplating this job, which is done in quite a deadpan way. Like, again, people were complaining that the crime itself was not exciting enough. But actually, I really like that. One of my favorite things in this film is the fact that they have to they have to, they break a piece of equipment in trying to drill through this wall, and they just have to stop the whole thing, go to like Wix or like tool hire, HSS tool hire or whatever it is, get a new one, and then go back the next morning. And like anyone who's ever done a DIY job in their home knows that's exactly what happens. You like break your drill bit, you have to go back to the, you have to go back to like Leyland or whatever, get a new one and carry on. It's so tedious.
You know what,
they that really well.
When he bought that replacement drill, you know what name he put down on the receipt? V. Jones. So they were living in the this sort of strange meta world where they knew that they were doing what was going to end up in, feel exactly like the perfect heist movie. Yeah. He actually signed his name as Vinnie Jones. Also, the reason I thought that the crime was so brilliantly handled was that these people were super professionals. Like Brian Reader, the character Michael Caine plays, he was first arrested at the age of 11. In 1971, he burrowed under a leather shop and sold and stole 268 safe deposits from under Lloyd's Bank's vault in London. And then in 1983, he was involved in a heist where they accidentally discovered £145 million in gold bullion in Heathrow, and he went to prison for that. These people were already experts, and then they also, in their retirement, because they were kind of at a loose end, they read books. Like Brian Reader read a book called The Diamond Underworld, and Danny Jones, the Ray Winston character, had a book called Forensics for Dummies, which actually appears in the film. And I was like, oh, is that a really corny joke? One of them is reading a Something for Dummies, and it was real, you know. So they did plan this over 3 years. So of course, when they get down there, the thing's going to be pretty much perfect. One of the problems, there's the only character who was never caught is a guy called Basil, in inverted commas. It's an amazing thing about the kind of criminal code, I suppose, that they've never, as far as I know, they've never given any information about who he was. And he's the one who got off with two-thirds of the stash, which has never been found. The safe place itself has gone into liquidation. This guy is out there somewhere in Europe. And he's the one who's played by a young actor in the film. And he's the only one who went in with a wig and a flat cap because he was aware of the CCTV. Now, when I was reading about the heist today, the reason they were caught was that they were all identified on CCTV. Yeah. So Basil surely could have disabled the CCTV the same way he disabled the alarms and got into the building. Did he do it deliberately, I'm wondering? Because he gave himself a proper disguise.
Is that a genuine speculation?
No, I just thought of it today. It's like, how come all these guys happen to be identified by face on CCTV, apart from the guy who could have disabled the CCTV, you know?
The sort of reason for them not, I mean, in the film, they sort of think, they call him a bit of a nonce, don't they, for wearing his cap and his wig. So you get the impression that they didn't do it just because they thought it wasn't old school.
And it made him look a bit
silly. But they could have worn, you know, balaclavas or something. That would have been old school, I guess.
I think they had like, different coats on or something like that. But
I just realised I read out in that list of cast, Basil is Charlie Cox. So he's the only one of the main cast that isn't the kind of A-grade established kind of national treasure.
Yes, and he's actually the one that got away. Yeah. I mean, what we should say is this idea you're talking about, the mixture of the tones to it, the kind of caper versus the grittiness. The reason it is kind of quite unique is that it does kind of play into the idea of like the Lavender Hill mob and the kind of the comedy of it.
Yeah.
But when it comes to dividing up the spoils, there are really quite sharp character turns among these men, and they're quite unpleasant to watch. And it's Jim Broadbent who kind of steals that, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's fantastic. They're him and Michael Caine have this real confrontation. I can't remember which of them says it. I'll have you in chunks.
Yeah. Terry Perkins is, I think, Jim Broadbent's character. And he was like, you know, he'd once doused a security guard in petrol and waved matches in his face and this kind of thing. Like, these were nasty, nasty guys.
Yeah.
And it's the first role I've seen Broadbent in, which is actually unpleasant and threatening. So I think, like, in terms of their careers, it's not just a kind of cozy caper for them to have done. It's got a bit of an edge.
He's the most threatening, isn't he? But they all have an edge of nastiness to them. Mm. Even the Brian Reader character, played by Michael Caine, who is the one that you're kind of allowed a bit of sympathy for, because it starts with the death of his wife and he's kind of
is all true.
Yeah, is it? Yeah. And he's rattling around this sort of quite big house on his own, and you know, he's a sad old man.
Mm.
And he seems a bit more kind of he seems less of an idiot than the others in terms of their kind of stupid pranks and stuff. But he has an edge of nastiness to him.
Yeah.
And is just probably as untrustworthy as the others when it comes
to. And so does Tom Courtney, who's really, he plays, I can't remember his name now, Kenny, who's the sort of lookout guy, who's the driver, who also literally did in real life fall asleep upstairs on the job trying to look out the window for security guards. And
they give him two instructions, stay awake and sort out your hearing.
Yeah. And he really did have like a failing hearing. Yeah. And Courtney's, I've seen him in the, he was actually in Unforgotten, which we spoke about once recently. And he's very good in his old age of playing these, and 45 years, playing these kind of so-called, like apparently sweet old men who've got a nastiness to them. And there's something about the way he talks and the way he grits his teeth and the way his teeth and his sort of lips look when he's like actually got a hardness about him. And even in the role of Kenny, who's this kind of completely dozy, stupid character, there's a kind of ruthless undercurrent to him. And I thought the sort of the most amazing sort of cameo in it really was Michael Gambon, who plays Billy the Fish. Who is this ridiculous, like Waiting for Godot kind of character who has about two words and his hair looks like he's been electrocuted. And he's just really like randomly charged with looking after some of the millions and millions pounds worth of jewels.
So he's the fence, isn't he? So he's the one who's employed to get rid of the stuff,
yeah,
basically. And he has a van delivering sort of fresh fish, which is why it's called Billy the Fish.
And in real life, that guy was chronic sleep apnea and deafness and incontinence. This is, it's all, it's, it was worse than it is in the film.
I mean, that, the, you know, they do, they, okay, so it's the same kind of comic trope throughout, but there are some really nice riffs on the age of these characters, like the hearing aid being one of them. I mean, my favourite is when they're talking about how to get rid of stolen loot. And I can't actually remember whether it's the loot from this job or from a previous job. And they talk about, you know, what about the internet? Why don't you do it online? And I think it's Tom Courtney's character.
Yeah,
says,
yeah.
Oh, eBay. Oh, no, I can't get that on my computer. Which is very, very accurate about how some older people think of technology.
He doesn't think he's got the software for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I like the simplicity of it and the fact that, of course, these guys are going to be able to do it fairly effectively. And of course, the police would find them quite fast. And it's just, you know, they just go home, they wait. That's that. And the police are brilliant. The only thing was there's like no, basically there's no female characters in it at all.
Absolutely none.
And so
it's
what
they're unapologetic about that,
unapologetic about it. Francesca Annis has 2 seconds at the beginning where she says two words and then dies. So in order to kind of rectify that a bit, they've made the elite Sweeney style flying squad of policemen. They've made them all women, if you noticed. And they weren't in real life. They're probably old guys as well, but they're like these beautiful young mixed race ladies.
Yeah. God, that's so true. I hadn't thought of that. So there also allows the, it's, God, we should say it's, the screenplay is Joe Pennell, who has fine Hollywood pedigree, and it's directed by
James Marsh,
that's
who did
it.
The Theory of Everything.
Did he do The Theory of Everything?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. I know him from Man on Wire and,
of course,
The Imposter, both of which are kind of documentaries that play with real life events and dramatizations. But Joe Pennell has some fun with Cockney rhyming slang, because why not? And various sort of bits of East End slang. And when they're talking about their sort of old days of crime, you know, again, who's it? The one thing I find when I'm trying to recall this film is the lines are slightly interchangeable between the characters. For any of them could have said this, but it's like, oh yeah, we kicked him in the cobblers, you know, up the Aristotle, you know, we might have kicked them in the biscuits, we might have poured petrol on them, but we never hurt them.
This happened very close to us as well. Our office, the New Statesman at the time, was at Farringdon, and we have another office in Hatton Gardens. And I remember when it happened, and when I was reading about the crime today, one of the initial investigations they did resulted in a burst gas main, which then caused a huge fire.
Yes.
Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And the whole cast and audience of The Lion King on one afternoon were made to leave out, you know, leave on the streets and do like a fire evacuation. And I think Mamma Mia as well. And I distinctly remember that happening because we were at work and we knew about this fire because like Twitter was, you know, telling us about the fire. And that was one of the first times these guys had been down into the basement. So, and then we came back after Easter that year, and it had all happened. So exciting. I don't think there's anything to steal in the New Statesman's Hatton Garden office.
Do you have anything in a safety deposit box?
I don't. What a weird idea that is.
Yes. Seems so archaic.
And also, like, apparently there's a load of stolen, everyone knows there's a load of stolen stuff being stored there anyway. So it's like crooks and wealthy people are working cheek by jowl. Mm. One of the things I was interested to see that was stolen was a titanium handbag given by Michael Jackson to Elizabeth Taylor.
That was among
the stuff.
Wow. Did they get that back?
I don't know if they ever got that back. Maybe Basil was using it now in the Costa del crime.
Basil, was he actually called Basil in real life?
No, it's just a name.
Okay. Yeah. So they made that for the film.
Yeah. No, that was the police name for him.
That was a police name.
Mm.
And the credits of the film at the end, they sort of dissolve the letters. So, and then you have this thing saying, best security something in London, as if it was like a kind of acronym.
Yes, an acronym, yeah.
Anyway, King of Thieves is, I believe, still in cinemas now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So yesterday morning, quite early before work, Tom, we went along to the Tate Modern, and we were the first people to take place on some sofas in front of a large cinema screen where a non-stop film had been playing all night already. So we turned up, I think, at 9:55, and we watched an hour and 10 minutes of The Clock by Christian Markley, which has already done the rounds a bit, hasn't it? It's been in New York. And tell me about the concept of this strange piece of art.
So this is a 24-hour video piece that's composed entirely of scenes from films in which time is either directly referenced through seeing a clock or a watch or people telling you what time it is. That's most of the clips, to be honest. And then it's intermingled with some of the clips are more broadly set at that time of day or somehow evoking the passage of time within that time of day. And yeah, it runs in sort of real time, so which is kind of a mind-boggling achievement. So when you're sitting there and someone on the screen is looking up at their office clock and it says 8:53, you look down at your watch and it is exactly 8:53. So that's the guiding principle of the piece. So yeah, it is very strange. Tate Modern are doing a couple of 24-hour screenings, but for normal kind of gallery times, this thing is just sitting there playing when no one's in there.
But you can go in the middle of the night, can't you?
Only on those special days.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah. So, I mean, in an ideal world, you'd have it open 24 hours the whole time because our film critic, Ryan Gilby, I think has seen more of it than us. I think it's hoping to, I imagine there's quite a few people who are hoping to try and see see all of it.
Those overnight ones are going to be well booked up though, aren't they? Because if that's the only chance you get to see what's happening at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the potential for 4 o'clock in the morning in cinema is going to be amazing. You'll get Pulp Fiction and Train Spotting and all the crazy druggy clubby stuff going on.
Yeah, so he actually, Christian Markley, first of all, I thought it was quite nice. He said, you know, people get frustrated. They feel like they want to see the whole thing. And he said, just enjoy it. Like, if you need to leave to go and get something to eat or go to the bathroom, just it's designed to be dipped in and out of. You don't have to sit there for hours at a time. But he also said that, okay, so there are obvious focal points where there's huge amounts of material to choose from. So midnight, you know, I think, you know, he's got Orson Welles and all sorts of things happening at midnight. Noon, you've got High Noon. And then there's all sorts of, like, as you say, kind of club scenes and crimes taking place and things in the early hours of the morning. But he actually said between 4 and 5 was the hardest one to film.
Really?
Yeah. And I would love to see that bit, because he said that's when he could bring in a lot of dream sequences.
Of course.
So I think between 4 and 5 in the morning, if you're lucky enough to see that section, you might see lots of dream sequences.
When I first heard of the idea, I thought it was quite poncy.
Yeah.
And I imagined I was going to go and see a chin strokey sort of thing that was just literally for film buffs. And I loved the lack of cultural snobbery to it. You know,
it's weirdly compelling, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Like, at, you know, just before 10 o'clock, you see the gates of Willy Wonka's chocolate factory yeah. opening. And then I recognized bits. I mean, it says like my knowledge of film, but basically I recognized bits from like Single White Female and yeah. Back to the Future and stuff like that. And it could be a lot more pretentious than it is, and it's very funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very there's a lot of humor in the edit, isn't
yeah.
there?
Yeah, there's a whole chunk that's just chosen because Johnny Depp's London accent is so bad.
I looked that up. It's From Hell, which is an adaptation of a graphic
yes.
novel, which I have heard of.
The Jack the Ripper thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's Johnny Depp and Robbie Coltrane. And Johnny Depp is just talking in this ridiculous
way worse than Dick Van Dyke
it's
kind of
totally
thing.
Dick Van Dyke territory. So yeah, I mean, me and you were sitting there for half of it. We're like, "What's that one? Do you recognise that one?" Like, it kind of, you sort of want to go there with a real film buff.
Or a film buff.
You could go
and
on
you
a
get
film
to
buff.
See. I love the fact you get to see these very famous actors in early obscure roles in like bad rom coms and things like that. And you just wonder what they are. But there is some system, isn't there, of working out what all these films are.
So Markley's never released a list. There are around 10,000 clips over the 24 hours from something between 3,000 and 5,000 films. And there's a community online that have tried to sort of piece it together. So there's a sort of crowdsourced page with all the timestamps, and then people have filled in what they...
Has he not released the titles because he didn't get the rights?
I think that must be partly it. So he didn't clear any of these. He's just taken a punt on it. I mean, it's great. It's worked out. But apparently this is partly why it's free. So museums tend not to charge for it. So it's free at Tate yeah. Modern. Like, you can just go. I think that's partly why, is that the idea of making lots of money out of it, you might get kind of Warner Brothers or whatever coming. But at this stage, you know, it's won the Golden Lion at the Venice Biennale. It's sold to all these major art institutions, you know. A studio who comes demanding thousands of dollars for the three Back to the Future clips is just going to look like
yeah.
an absolute idiot.
Philistine.
So it has been around for a while. It was made in 2010. It took him 3 years, I think, to make.
With a team of researchers.
Six assistants. Mm. It started, he put an ad up in this, there was a kind of art house video shop in Clerkenwell, which has gone now, and he put an ad up in the window of that for people.
Wow.
And then once he'd recruited his six assistants, he just got them watching as many films as possible, mainly on VHS apparently. And they each had instructions of how to rip scenes from the VHS. So they kind of made the clips for him. And he started off saying, get me, you know, bits from thrillers, people looking at watches, countdowns. And then after a while of that, he just said, actually, just get me anything
with yeah. clocks in it.
Anything with clocks in it or with time in it.
But did he do it before Ridley Scott did Life in a Day? He did, didn't he, in that case, 2010.
That was 2011, I think, the Ridley Scott.
Right, which was the thing that was like, again, that was actually a crowdsourced
amazing that. Yeah.
film that took place, but it was condensed into a normal film length, 24 hours in the life of the world, showing people getting up for breakfast and having lunch and everything. And it had all been submitted by clips of individuals, hadn't it, I think. I mean, I thought I had a strangely kind of emotional reaction to it because, you know, it made me feel, we watched an hour of it.
Mm.
And by the end of that hour, I felt like I'd been there for a day. we'd seen countless people having breakfast between like 9:55 and 11:10 or whatever. But we'd seen bank jobs, we'd seen funerals, we'd seen weddings, and it just made me think how huge the world is and like how much stuff is going on at any one time. Like, have you ever flown above, like you fly above a huge city like Los Angeles late at night and you look down at these tiny little cubes that are lit up and they're the houses and you can't even see the end of that city. And then you think, this is just one city on the planet and all these things are going on in these houses, all these conversations are happening and all these dramas are taking place. And it just kind of blows your mind. And I think in a funny kind of way, he's achieved it. You can go and see 1 hour of it and you just think the world is huge.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
Yeah, it is. And the editing really sort of brings that to life. So sometimes he'll cut, you know, sometimes he'll make a connection between things. So you'll see like several like subway chases all together. And then sometimes it will be a kind of complete juxtaposition. So it will be Humphrey Bogart in a kitchen cutting a grapefruit in half, and it will cut to, you know, I don't know, a scene in a house with an inspector asking people to come up with their alibis, which will then cut to Denzel Washington in Deja Vu kind of being submerged under the water in his car.
Yeah, one person's being submerged under a car at the moment, somebody else is just waking up in another film. And it's just that idea of the how much you can pack into 1 hour versus somebody who's just asleep throughout the whole hour is just kind of powerful.
And he, because he's a sound artist, the only he'd be very well known to people who know about sound art, and I'm sure people in the art world generally. I had only had one encounter with his stuff, which was in 2005, I saw a piece of his at St. Luke's Church, you know, that one near the Barbican, called Tabula Rasa, which was him basically with turntables, like destroying records and like scratching.
What was he there in real life?
Yeah. Wow. He performed it. So it was a kind of like noise piece, which is sort of brilliant at moments. And at other moments, kind of, I felt like it was the most tedious thing I've ever seen. So he has a background in sound, and the other nice thing about this is he really didn't want to like just fade in and out the sound from each clip. So sometimes you get the sound from one clip carrying on throughout the other ones. Sometimes apparently he's actually recorded new audio to go.
It felt like some of it was unique to the project rather than the film that was happening.
Yeah, it's
very cool.
Were there any, I mean, it's tedious for us to describe the scenes. We mentioned Johnny Depp. Were there any other bits from the chunk we saw that you particularly enjoyed?
Well, I enjoyed moments of Moonraker starring Roger Moore. Yeah. I mean, I think it just like, this is why it's such a universal project, because it's whatever you grew up with and you recognise just shows your film taste. And then you get, you know, a miserable Tony Hancock being given cornflakes at 10:05, which was just, I loved that bit as well. Yeah.
I love the scene from the Breakfast Club with Judd Nelson. His character's called John Bender. He's just ripping up a book and he says, what even is this? Molyeur really pumps my nads.
I also wrote that quote down. I think at that moment we both got our pens out.
But there's also a couple of really intriguing things. Like there was a film that we both felt like we kind of half recognised. But I looked it up afterwards. It's Charles Bronson, this guy with this kind of thin moustache, wandering around. But I have no idea what film it
running
is.
on a cliff top.
There's one. He's in it. He was in it twice in the chunk we saw. But even the crowdsourcing guy has just put Charles Bronson runs through.
Amazing.
It, you know. I'm sure
I liked,
someone.
A very young Natalie Portman looking at the clock and saying the words, "Shit, it's 10. I have to be there at 10." And then you see a blind man running with a stick out of the door of the house that she's in, and I'm just wondering what that was. But that was so deadpan. It's 10. I have to be there at 10.
Did you find yourself getting very tense throughout it, or did you find that actually you kind of relaxed into the rhythm?
I didn't get tense. I just thought, I just found it quite overwhelmingly like packed in that I was ready to go after 20 minutes because so much had happened in that 20 minutes. And you were like, I think we should stay for an hour. I was like, oh, fuck. But I'm glad I did stay for an hour because when the hour turns, quite big things happen. Yeah. Like he obviously has fun with the turning of the hour. So when it became 11 o'clock, there are kind of like dramatic things happening and stuff, and also very undramatic things. So if you imagine that repeated over 24 hours.
I loved also the amount, I don't know whether this recurs throughout the whole 24 hours, but there's quite a lot of people sort of correcting clocks.
Yeah. winding watches up so that it hits exactly the time that it happens to be at that second.
It was a really weird one, which was a really long shot of like a bunch of monks just correcting the time on a clock, which kind of, for some reason, I found hilarious. It's true. There's a lot of humor in it. And one of the reviews I read said you would expect this to be kind of quite bleak and depressing.
Definitely.
It's all about the passing of time, you know, which is we all feel is a big burden, but actually it's weirdly uplifting.
It's uplifting because of the amount that he's packed in,
which
is what we want to do with life.
Yeah. And what we try to do with this podcast. I really recommend you go and see it. The clock is on till 20th of January at Tate Modern. And there are a couple of 24-hour screenings within that, but it's free. It's free throughout. We're going to stay in a cinematic mold. Mold? Mode? Are we going to be in a mold or a mode?
A mode.
Or a commode.
In a commode.
In a commode. Well, this podcast room is not far off. For our non-anniversary, which is our celebration of a sort of oddly shaped anniversary of a not particularly significant cultural event. Kate, what do we have this week?
So in September 1999, which according to my maths is 19 years ago. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Jamie Babbitt released her film But I'm a Cheerleader. Jamie Babbitt is also famous for her lesbian movie The Itty Bitty Titty Committee and for directing things like Gilmore Girls and Malcolm in the Middle. So for some reason, even though it came out in September, we saw this at university, which would have been end of 2000. And it was one of the films of our defining of our first year at university. It is about a 17-year-old girl who's a cheerleader and who has a boyfriend, a football player called Jared. And she doesn't enjoy kissing Jared and she prefers looking at her fellow cheerleaders instead. So combined with the fact that the girl is a vegetarian and likes Melissa Etheridge, her family and friends decide that she is in fact a lesbian and they send her off to a camp to basically beat her homosexuality out of her called True Directions, where she will reorientate. And the person who helps her to get access to this camp is an ex-gay called Mike, who's played by RuPaul, who comes to the house looking, you know, as macho as RuPaul could look and sort of says, you know, really, Megan, you have to go and change yourself. So it's a very, very surreal, it's like a John Waters film. It's shot in lurid lime greens and pinks and yellows. And it's extremely bizarre because she goes to this camp, this kind of Christian style summer camp, to become straight. And she's put, of course, into a dormitory with a load of other girls who are also lesbians. And then on the other side of the camp, there's a dormitory full of boys who are also gay. And of course, the inevitable happens. And it's a very, very funny, very sweet film. And it probably wouldn't like be very funny now because it's sort of one of those things, a bit like Scary Movie that came out at the time, that the jokes that it made seemed quite bold at the time because, I don't know, I mean, they'd be seen as very unpolitically correct and unreconstructed and reconstructed now. But I remember seeing it when we were like 20 and just thinking this was quite groundbreaking, that she has to go to True Directions to beat her homosexuality out of her.
And has it had an afterlife?
It's just one of those films that everyone who saw it remembers and thought was great, but it's not really talked about. It's a kind of a bit of a cult film. And it just amused us very much. And I might have to go back and see whether it holds up at all. And I assume that it was just in that special little pocket of time when you could... Remember how Scream came out? And Scream seemed really clever because it was referencing other horror movies.
Yeah.
And there was this little pocket at the end of the 90s where humour seemed extremely sharp and probably wasn't in retrospect, but everyone was caught up in it at the time.
Yeah, that's true. And you also had some quite big mainstream films that were deploying some quite sharp sharp humor like that.
Yeah. But I mean, Scary Movie doesn't work at all now.
Yeah.
But that had a guy in a wheelchair in it who was a really unpleasant character, which at the time was quite revolutionary because they would always have the guy in the wheelchair as being like a very sort of saintly character and stuff. And this one was just horrible. that's kind of what you get in this. But it's worth rewatching just to see the ex-gay Mike as well, played by RuPaul pre-Drag Race.
Okay. So happy 19th anniversary.
To But I'm a Cheerleader.
Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. We've been edited by Caroline Crampton. We've got a really good issue of The New Statesman this week.
We have.
So you should buy it at your local WH Smith. I won't bore you by telling you what's actually in it. But
next week's is fat too, and the one afterwards. This time of year is the fat issue.
Two fat ones.
Yeah.
Not
all just advertising. So I'm not trying to con you by saying it's an extra like 18 pages of adverts, which is also true, but... Some of the adverts were enjoyable, some are less so.
Which ones did you enjoy?
Oh, I can't say. I wouldn't want to ruin the content at this stage.
And we're going to leave you with
a groovy tune called Godspeed by the groovy band Pistol Jazz.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.